It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off this week. Coming up on Central Time, the deadline for an agreement with Iran has passed, but negotiations apparently continue. We'll get the latest from Washington with Paul Singer of USA Today. First, Wisconsin's new DNA collection law goes into effect today. That means anyone arrested for a violent felony and anyone convicted of either a felony or misdemeanor will have to submit a DNA sample at the time of arrest. Wisconsin becomes the 29th state to adopt such a law, which the U.S. Supreme Court said was okay back in 2013, though for some, concerns still remain over rights being violated. Joining us now to talk more about this new law is Donald Downs. He's professor of political science, law, and journalism at UW-Madison. Donald, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. So first off, how exactly does this law work?
Well, when a person is arrested for a violent felony, then they'll get a swab taken out of their cheek and then have their DNA tested to see if it's turned up in any other kinds of crimes. And the Supreme Court upheld that, as you mentioned, back in 2013. This goes a little further because it also allows people to have that done if they're convicted of a nonviolent felony, because the previous law the Supreme Court dealt with only concerned violent felonies. So now if you're convicted of a violent nonviolent felony or even a misdemeanor, that can be done. So it expands the scope of what the Supreme Court upheld back in 2013.
Now, the justification for this law, it isn't so much the case that you've been arrested for that's of interest here. It's to see if the person that's being arrested might be connected to another open case. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, there's always been an exception for searches into arrests. If you arrest somebody, going all the way back to for several decades now, Supreme Court's allowed the body of the person to be searched in the area of immediate control for either weapons or evidence. But usually that evidence pertains to the crime the person's arrested for. And this could be, you know, any kind of DNA that might have appeared on any kind of crime scene now involving even nonviolent felonies going, you know, years back, perhaps. So it's a broader kind of thing.
And so this DNA gets collected, I guess, classified. What happens to it? How is it kept on file? Do we know that?
Yeah, well, it's kept in crime labs and, you know, institutions related to the crime labs, and it's just sort of kept on hold. You know, they have ways of storing that. I don't exactly know how that's done, but it's linked to, you know, the way they preserve evidence from crime scenes all over the country. It's been going on for a long time. There's some concern that, you know, it could be tampered with. There has been some evidence in recent decades of technicians playing games with the evidence, and some innocent people have been convicted. So that's one of the concerns with it. The other is just that it's even more of a record keeping now of the state of your DNA heritage, which was a concern back in before the Supreme Court 2 years ago, but the court dismissed that.
Talking to Donald,
they dismissed it, but they said the benefits of this kind of process outweighed the invasion of privacy. That's probably a better way of putting it.
Talking to Donald Downs of the UW-Madison about the state's new DNA collection law that just went into effect today. Well, let's look at some of the arguments in that U.S. Supreme Court case. This is one that kind of split the usual partisan divide of the court. What were some of the concerns that the dissenting justices, the ones who didn't want this kind of collection, what case did they make?
Yeah, well, probably the main one was Justice Scalia. You know, it's sort of interesting. He's a conservative kind of guy, but when it comes to Fourth Amendment cases, he's often been on the more libertarian kind of side. He just said that this could open the door to DNA testing in all sorts of other contexts as well, because you're now taking this evidence with the suspicion that maybe someone might have committed some other kind of crime some other place. So he actually said in the decision, in his dissent, that, well, what's to prevent TSA from taking a swab of your cheek when you pass through the airport? Because, you know, maybe you committed some other crime someplace else. Now, you know, maybe that's a little hyperbolic. This could still be limited to those situations where there's an arrest or a conviction. But he was really concerned about the slippery slope aspect. And he put it kind of in the context of just, you know, the broader powers the state has attained over the years in law enforcement. And I know that people on both the left and the right are concerned about overcriminalization. And now this extends to misdemeanors, this law in Wisconsin. Interestingly, you know, the Koch Foundation, right, the very conservative foundation, is now working with the ACLU to deal with the question, the concerns about over-criminalization and too many people being in prison. So this sort of goes against the grain of those concerns.
And as I recall, Justice Scalia had a quote, something like, would the people who had the American Revolution have willingly submitted to the crown, probing their mouth?
Classic Scalia, you know.
Now, at the same time, Justice Kennedy, he was on the majority in this one. He says, no, this cheek swab, it's like, you know, we fingerprint you, we photograph you, we might use that fingerprint or photograph to connect you to other crimes. No different.
Yeah, and sort of, I think he said that the DNA swabs like this are the fingerprints of the 21st century. And, the court had there were two concerns about this. One is the physical intrusion of the search, right? Because it's technically it is a search. So the Fourth Amendment's in play here. They're touching your going inside your mouth and touching your inside of your cheek there. So, but it's a pretty minor one, and the court, at least in terms of the physical intrusion part. But that was the first concern, and that's a very traditional Fourth Amendment concern. The other concern was what's the record that is shown by DNA, and it gets into your genetic history. And that's a bit of a book about you. And it's not about what you've done. You know, it's not like going through your diaries or something like that. But it's still an extensive record. And no one's saying that the police shouldn't be able to do that. The question is whether or not they needed to have some sort of probable cause in order to do that. And so the probable cause to link this person to another kind of crime, maybe that would be, then you could get a warrant for that or get it, make sure a judge would authorize the sweep, the going into the cheek before the police did it. This is automatic. You know, once you're arrested, they can do it, period. And if you're convicted, they can do it, even though they may not have any cause whatsoever to believe you committed another crime, they can still do it.
And it seems
I think it's really three things. One, it's a minor physical intrusion. Two, it's the extensive record that's in the DNA, which is sort of a bit of a book about you. And then third, it just gives, the police broader search powers to go after crimes or misdemeanors that they may not have any cause to believe you committed at all, which is a Fourth Amendment issue.
And it seems like one of the lines that is crossed here that has some people worried is, okay, if you're convicted, we get it. You're giving up some of your rights. You might be incarcerated, can't vote, that sort of thing. If you're arrested, you might still be innocent. And so this is too intrusive on someone who might still be innocent of this crime.
Well, true. But that's going to be true for any traditional search incident to arrest. You know, supposing that you're arrested for, they have probable cause to believe that you committed shoplifting. And then they stop you, they arrest you, they have a right to search you. Well, what if they find marijuana in your pocket that they had no reason to believe that was there ahead of time? So the concern you raise is always going to accompany a search incident to arrest. But what this does is it just expands that, okay, beyond where it was, because now they can trace any kind of thing, any kind of DNA, footprint you may have left anywhere else around the country or anywhere within the United States.
Well, you know, when we look at this, there have been cases about how much of your cell phone can police search when you're arrested while you're carrying a smartphone. There's a lot of ways in which our technology is getting out ahead of our legal system, it seems like.
That's been an issue for a long time. I mean, a lot of interesting cases. You know, they had the GPS case back in 3 or 4 years ago. Back in 2001, they had infrared testing outside of a house. I forget exactly the technical term for that, but where the police would have these technology to catch heat waves coming out of the house. And Scalia actually wrote an opinion, that 5-4 decision, said they need a warrant before they can do that, even though they're outside of your house. So, yeah, I mean, the court's always having to keep up on the technological aspects here. No question.
Donald, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's Donald Downs. He's professor of political science, law, and journalism at UW-Madison. The deadline to reach an agreement with Iran on nuclear capabilities and sanctions has passed, but the talks continue. Now that the deadline has passed, though, Congress is expected to put increasing pressure on the president to maybe walk away, possibly increase sanctions. Also out of the nation's capital, we found out last week that Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid is not going to seek re-election, clearing the way for new Democratic leadership on the Senate side. USA Today's Washington correspondent Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, let's talk about this Iran deal. This negotiation extended again. Republican lawmakers opposing terms of these negotiations from the start. What are we hearing from them now as this goes on?
Well, you know, the longer this drags on, as you know, the supposedly March 31st was the deadline for those talks to conclude in some sort of agreement, and they did not hit that target. Now, John Kerry is still hanging out there to try and cement a few more details and hopefully get some sort of a framework deal. I mean, I think what you're going to see will be vague enough that the administration will be able to declare they've won something, but I doubt it's going to be enough to satisfy critics who basically argue in Congress that you know, you're not getting anything out of Iran, and the only way to really deal with them at this point is to increase sanctions on them and force them to give up some portion of their nuclear program. You know, the administration has argued all along that diplomacy is the way to go here. I mean, there is not really any other viable option, but opponents, and particularly, you know, with the support of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, they really argued that there's no good deal with Iran because Iran can't be trusted. They're going to cheat. But Democrats argue the only other alternative, essentially, is war, which these talks are supposed to head off. So we'll see what happens. Congress is still out of session for a week or so, so that gives the administration a little bit more breathing room. But yeah, I anticipate this will be something that they'll be trying to address promptly when they return.
And while Congress is off, some leaders, Republicans, are in Israel during this recess.
Right, and again, they are standing. There's photographs of Mitch McConnell and Netanyahu shaking hands, and McConnell saying basically, "We're on your side. We don't want any kind of bad deal, and we're not going to let the president advance a bad deal. We're going to get serious with Iran." I mean, it's an interesting picture to have the Senate majority leader standing with a foreign leader saying basically, "We don't trust our president either."
And with this deal, one thing you just mentioned was that some in Congress want to pass sanctions now to turn up the heat. Also,
right.
If a deal is reached, Congress wants to have say on it, whether it gets approved here or not. We've talked about that a little in past weeks. What's the case they can make? Do they have some say over whether Congress agrees to what the president agrees to?
Well, you know, this is a letter that a bunch of Republican senators sent to the Iranian leadership. It's kind of an odd tack. Also saying, basically, whatever deal you strike with the president, keep in mind, A, he's only going to be the president for two more years, and B, we still have oversight authority, which they do. And in theory, there's a number of things they can do to attack the funding for any deal if they think it's weak. They can take a number of steps to try and basically subvert any deal. But I believe the president is empowered to sign a deal by himself without Congress having any kind of, you know, vote of approval. So the question will be what tools they will then have at their disposal to try and get in the way. But again, if the deal has any teeth to it, I presume Congress would want to let it see if it works.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about the latest from Congress. Well, let's turn to some big news now within Congress. Harry Reid announced last week he's retiring. That leaves that top Democratic spot in the Senate open. He introduced Chuck Schumer, a senator from New York. Does Harry Reid's blessing mean he gets the gig?
Yeah. Pretty much. Schumer is going to take that spot, and Schumer had locked up a lot of support from Democrats for the spot, and the guy, sort of the most likely guy to challenge Schumer for that was the whip, Dick Durbin from Illinois, and he basically conceded the spot to Schumer. Now, keep in mind, this is still 2 years away. We'll still have Harry Reid to kick around for a couple of years, but this will be in the next Congress, which will convene in 2017 after the next elections. Now, you know, we're just talking here about the leadership of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Senate. The question is whether that will be the majority leader or the minority leader, and it depends on how the elections go for the Democrats, obviously. And having Harry Reid step down creates a seat where Democrats are in some serious jeopardy. I mean, that's going to be a very hotly contested seat, as it was the last time Harry Reid ran in 2010. I believe the woman he beat was named Sharon Engel, and it was a catfight with a Tea Party opponent. This time around, the Republicans think they can recruit somebody better. In fact, I believe the governor there is a very popular Hispanic Republican governor who could be a serious contender for that seat. So there's lots of possibilities for interesting politics here I just don't think that the case of who will be the Democratic leader will be where the interesting politics is played.
Is it important, the leadership of the minority party in the Senate, more so than in the House?
Yeah. In the Senate, the minority party has a lot more ability to monkey around and gum up the works, as it were. And by the way, I will say that Harry Reid and for that matter, on the Republican side, Mitch McConnell, when he was a minority leader, both real masters of the Senate, really understand the rules well, really know how to throw up hurdles where need be to legislation they've opposed. I suspect Schumer will maintain that ability and those skills. He's just going to have to practice a little bit. He doesn't have sort of the... Schumer is best known for being the guy who is on television probably more than any other Democrat, the joke being that, you know, the most dangerous place in Washington is between Chuck Schumer and a microphone.
Well, let's stay with the Senate side of things. And the Senate Democrats, I don't know too much about this one yet, but an indictment of a senator from New Jersey, Bob Menendez.
Yeah, it just popped up. And basically what I can tell you is there's been an ongoing case for some period of time that New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez on the Foreign Affairs Committee has been accused of essentially swapping official actions for favors from a pal of his, a guy named Melgen, who is a Florida eye doctor. The things that we do know is that Menendez accepted some flights from Melgen to the Dominican Republic over a period of time. He has reimbursed Melgen something in the range of $50,000 or $60,000. I don't remember exactly what the number was for those flights, agreeing that they were sort of inappropriate gifts. But the allegations have been that he may have also been taking official action on behalf of Melgen's companies in exchange for some of these favors. I have not yet seen the indictment. I'm told it's just out, and I'm told there are 13 corruption charges against him. And I'm told that he's going to speak on this topic at 7 o'clock Eastern time tonight. So this is just developing now. Whatever the case, whether he is in serious legal jeopardy or not, I do not know. But it is never good if you are a sitting member of the U.S. Senate and the Justice Department says you're a crook.
Let's switch over now to the House, where the news is they did a thing in a bipartisan way, and it wasn't something symbolic like Puppy Appreciation Month or something like that. The doc fix, this thing's been in the works for a long time. What happened? What did they do with this?
Well, you know, the doc fix is one of these things every year. Apparently, and you'll forgive me if I am not by any way, shape, or form an expert in healthcare, but apparently there was some provision in this law that every year they'd have to basically patch a hole. The hole would stop doctors from being paid their full reimbursement for treating Medicare patients. And so doctors would just say, look, we'll just stop treating them. And so Congress always has to find some way around it every year to come up with, you know, a few billion dollars to patch. They call it the doc fix. What the House has achieved here is an actual deal between Nancy Pelosi and Speaker John Boehner. It received something like 400 votes, it was a bipartisan vote to fix this. It's I think $200 billion or so to, over the next 10 years, make sure that doctors who are providing these Medicare services are being reimbursed without any threat to their payment. That is called legislating. It's called legislating in a bipartisan fashion. It is not cheap or easy. They have to, you know, this adds to the deficit. It's one of those things that, you know, you bite the bullet and you say, we have to actually pay for this entitlement. So it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to see that it got broad bipartisan support. This dysfunctional Congress was actually able to grab onto an issue that was important and needed to be addressed, and they addressed it. I presume the Senate will take it up when they return.
Some of the quotes I saw from Congress people sounded almost like surprised, like, this is what a deliberative body does, or maybe we could cooperate on other stuff, too. I mean, is this going to be the spark that generates a spirit of bipartisan compromise, or is just a flash in the pan?
Well, I'm not going to put my money on bipartisan compromise, but, you know, I mean, there is this kind of, I don't know, maybe it's great news that they've figured out a new way to sit down and actually work together, and maybe it's just the sad irony of our times that, you know, Congress high-fives itself for doing what it's supposed to do, which is pass a bill to fix a law, broken law, you know, I don't know. But, hey, give them credit, it's Easter. We'll celebrate the holiday with them.
Did I see a picture of John Boehner giving Nancy Pelosi a kiss on the cheek after this thing, or was that some weird Photoshop deal? That really happened, right?
I guess so, yeah. again, spirit of Easter.
All right. Well, there, briefly, as we wrap up, Paul Singer, a big tribute to late Senator Ted Kennedy, dedication of a new institution is on. A lot of people spoke. A lot of people talked about spirit of bipartisanship that they miss since he's been gone. Was there really that spirit, or is this just rose-tinted glasses with 2020 hindsight?
Well, you know, Kennedy every now and then could really reach across the aisle. I think it was healthcare was one of the big things that he had reached across the aisle with to work with the Reagan administration. I mean, he was a guy who was capable of being a bipartisan compromiser. He was also a liberal firebrand. So, rose-colored glasses, we all look back in the good old days. But I think there's just an opportunity for everyone to sit down and say, you know, this guy was a historic figure, and we deserve to he deserves some respect at this event.
Paul, thanks as always.
Thanks, Rob. Talk to you soon.
That was USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us every Wednesday at this time with the latest from Washington. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. Coming up, we'll talk to a guest from a Milwaukee group focused on helping former prison inmates find jobs. First, homicides in Milwaukee have roughly tripled so far this year compared to the first 3 months of 2014. Some people say a bill in Madison to eliminate waiting periods for handgun purchases would only make things worse. But Governor Scott Walker says he backs that legislation. Chuck Kornbach has this update on gun violence in Wisconsin's largest city.
More than 30 people were murdered in Milwaukee during the first quarter of this year. Almost all were shot to death. It's been a busy time for some folks from Milwaukee inner city congregations Allied for Hope, who hold sidewalk prayer vigils for the deceased.
God, as we gather this morning to remember Richard, to pray for him, to thank you for the 57 years that he had here.
On this March day, the group remembers 57-year-old Richard Harris, who police say was shot in the street outside his home. Harris's brother Joseph comes by unexpectedly and talks about his sibling.
I know one thing, he didn't bother no one, and he stayed with my mom. He helped people out.
Last year at this time, there were plenty of non-fatal shootings in Milwaukee, but the death toll was about a third of this year's number. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn has occasionally been in the media talking about the increase in murders. Last week, he was asked about it again, and whether any police officers dismayed by former officer Christopher Manny's failure to win his job back in the Dontre Hamilton case are up for the challenge on the streets.
Now, we're going to do our best to continue to provide them the training and the support and the tactics they need to be successful. But we recognize that we're facing a significant problem right now, and we are going to be committed to getting it under control.
Flynn says his officers have already seized about 520 guns from criminals this year, 100 more than last year at this time. In some of the more violent neighborhoods, a new violence prevention program is trying to get underway.
It ends now.
Come on now, brother.
And it starts right now.
Come on, brother.
That's all I have to say.
A coalition of Milwaukee churches, neighborhood groups, and community activists gather at a news conference to announce a safe zone initiative that aims to interrupt or head off potential violence. William Harris plans to be one of the so-called hood ambassadors. He says he used to be part of the problem and served time in prison.
But we're here now to put a stamp on this. If you don't believe us now, you will believe us, because we're here. We're here to make this happen. We're going to make this happen.
But even as some work for safe zones, there's concern that some state lawmakers and Governor Walker may take a step that would increase guns and gun violence in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the state. A bill partway through the legislature would eliminate the 48-hour waiting period to buy a handgun.
Bad news and bad thinking. I can't imagine why anyone would want to support that.
Milwaukee prayer vigil attendee Joyce Elwanger takes a dim view of doing away with a cooling off period to get a gun.
A lot of the incidents that we see are incidents of retaliation, instant retaliation and of anger, and of anger that could be dissipated before something as tragic as a life is taken.
But Governor Walker appears ready to sign the waiting period elimination bill if the measure reaches his desk, after maybe some tweaks to protect domestic violence victims. Walker says criminal background checks on gun buyers can now be done quickly.
We want to make it hard for criminals to get access to illegal guns. but make it convenient for law-abiding citizens to use a firearm.
In about 10 days, Walker and other possible GOP presidential candidates plan to speak at the National Rifle Association annual meeting in Tennessee. In Milwaukee, people are hoping April is not another bad month for gun homicides. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It could be hard for anyone to find a job, but for job seekers with criminal records, it can be way more difficult. As reported recently in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, ex-inmates often spend months, even years, unemployed after they're released from prison. And without a job, those former inmates are more likely to end up back in prison. Wendell Rischke is with us now. He's the executive director of Project Return, a Milwaukee nonprofit that helps ex-inmates adjust to life after prison. Wendell, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I know you focus on a wide area of things involving reentry to life after prison. Focusing in on jobs, what are some of the main obstacles that former inmates encounter?
There are many different areas in which an individual is lacking when they're getting out of an institution. A lot of individuals don't have the proper education, don't have the proper job skills, don't have the prerequisite work experience. A lot of the individuals that we work with don't have or are feeling so down about themselves or feeling so down about who they are that they don't believe that they can be successful. Finding a job, maintaining employment. So that's kind of what we're trying to do with it with our clients is to bolster them up, let them know that they can do this, that they can be successful, and then help them with that process of like getting a resume written up, filling out job applications, getting in front of employers, getting that interview so that they can be successful.
Well, those are all huge hurdles you just listed, and we'll talk a little more about that in a bit. But one thing that leapt to my mind is discrimination or being weeded out by the employer because of the stigma of being an ex-con.
And there are definitely employers out there that do that. Luckily, in Wisconsin, we do have legislation that protects individuals that makes it that an employer cannot discriminate against somebody unless the job is substantially related to the crime that they've committed. For instance, a bank robber should not be working as a bank teller. We can kind of understand those types of things. Unfortunately, some of those criteria are broadly exercised by employers, and it's very difficult to be able to prove job discrimination or discrimination based on a felony conviction. So that is a huge problem that we're running into. And what's huge about it is that people believe that there are companies out there, people who are returning from incarceration believe that there are companies out there that just kind of paint a broad stroke across everybody that has a felony conviction, and so no employer out there is going to hire me, so I might as well not even try. So that is a very dangerous thing that is in our community as well.
So for someone to make a successful reentry to life outside of prison and not end up back in prison, how important is finding a job?
Employment is very important. It's not the end-all, be-all. There are many facets that will help an individual returning from incarceration maintain sobriety, maintain their freedom, not falling back into prison, not falling back into criminal thinking patterns. But employment, I mean, if you have steady full-time employment, if you have family-sustaining jobs where you're able to pay child support or take care of your family, cover your rent and all that kind of things, it just is a huge headache that you don't have to worry about, that you got that taken care of, and you can start taking care of all these other pieces as well. Unfortunately, what we want to do in Wisconsin, well, in the world, is when it comes to reentry, folks who are dealing with reentry, is we want those individuals to, you know, address one part of their life at a time. And you have all these things that are coming at the individual at once, so they have to holistically take care of themselves. And unfortunately, a lot of times, lack of employment is such a burden that it leads an individual down into substance abuse and leads an individual into committing new crimes and falling back into criminal thinking patterns. So it is a huge, huge issue.
Talking to Wendell Rischke with Project Return in Milwaukee about the challenges many ex-inmates face at trying to get a job after they've been in prison. Well, Wendell, you mentioned the lack of job skills and the lack of confidence to get a job. How do you, at Project Return, help people build those skills, build that confidence?
Well, everything we do is on a one-on-one basis, so it's really working with that particular individual, helping that individual to recognize that they've got worth, that they've got the abilities in the community, and to know how to sell them. So many of the individuals that we're working with, don't believe that they've got the skills, and two, are very ill-prepared to be able to know how to talk the right talk to be able to get the job. So working that individual through mock interviews, helping the individual with resumes, helping the individual understand what it is that employers are looking for and be able to sell themselves in that way. And a lot of individuals, it is just getting their foot in the door. We have a case manager here at Project Return who, when he returned from incarceration, he spent 3 years unemployed. He did not give up on himself. He would do odd jobs working for people, helping to re-roof houses, shoveling sidewalks and stuff. What got him over the hump was a transitional job. And a transitional job is a subsidized employment that you make minimum wage, you get this opportunity to be able to sell yourself for 6 months, and he was placed at Project Return for that 6 months. And after the 6 months, he did such a great job for us that we were able to hire him on full-time.
Are there a lot of programs like this offered by the government or community groups that can help in this situation?
There are some. There needs to be more. We are working with a group, MICA and Wisdom, throughout the state of Wisconsin, trying to increase funding for transitional jobs. And it does have some bipartisan support, so we're very hopeful that in this biennial budget that we will get a little bit more money for that, not just in Milwaukee, but statewide. Unfortunately, it had been larger. The budget for that had been cut, but we're looking to increase that budget again.
Is part of the effort here to recruit businesses, to recruit employers, to be willing to give former inmates a shot?
Definitely, definitely. They have to be on the front end of the work we're doing. If we don't have employers buying into it, if we don't have employers that believe that folks returning from incarceration add value to our community and can be successful post-release, we're not going to be successful with the reentry efforts we're working towards.
We're talking to Wendell Rischke from Project Return in Milwaukee about the difficulties ex-inmates can face trying to find a job after they're released from prison. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been part of this story? Have you or maybe someone you know spent time in prison? What kind of challenges were there in getting a job afterward? If you're an employer, have you hired former inmates? Would you be willing to? What would it take to convince you to give it a try? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Wendell Rischke from Project Return, talking about the difficulties ex-inmates face after their release from prison and how hard it is to find a job. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Have you been in this situation or maybe someone close to you? What are the obstacles to finding a job after prison? As an employer, have you hired former inmates? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Adam on the line in Milwaukee. Adam, hi.
Hi. Great conversation. I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on why your guest thinks that so much of the burden should be on taxpayers in terms of subsidized programs instead of shifting focus and putting the burden on, like, employers to go out and hire these workers.
Adam, thanks for the call. Wendell, it should be more on the employers than on taxpayers to help.
Ideally, we would love to be able to see that. What transitional jobs do and offer is for individuals who have limited to no work experience or who are experiencing major difficulties in entering into the workforce. So it is an incentive program for getting people into jobs and into work environments that they might not otherwise be able to get into. Not saying that the majority of individuals returning from incarceration should go through transitional jobs. In fact, studies have proven that it's not effective for a lot of individuals. But for the right individuals getting into transitional employment, it really is the step that people need to be successful and to remain successful moving forward, that without it, their likelihood of being successful is very, very limited.
And one of the fiscal arguments I've seen here is if former inmates don't get a job, they are more likely to end up back in prison on the taxpayer dime.
Right. Yes. And I mean, that's conservatively about $30,000 a year, whereas for transitional employment earning minimum wage, it's significantly less.
Adam, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Ellen with us in Green Bay. Ellen, hi.
Hi. I work in a federal prison camp. I'm a contractor. I work with inmates on a large vermicomposting project, and I've seen just amazing results with these inmates when they're given a chance to really run the system themselves and make the decisions about what happens when and how, and looking at what the weather is and the temperature. They really, really learn how to be responsible and make excellent decisions, and I just hope when they get out they can get jobs, because they'd be wonderful, wonderful employees.
Ellen, thanks for that call. That thing brings up a couple things, Wendell. The idea that maybe contrary to popular belief, I don't know, ex-inmates have the potential to be good employees.
There are employers that we know of that swear by hiring formerly incarcerated individuals will say that they're the best employees that they've ever had. Loyal workforce, looking for somebody to take a shot on them, looking for somebody that's willing to give them that chance. And when the employer does give them the chance, they're very loyal and stick with the company through thick and thin, because they realize that this company took a chance on me, believed in me. I'm not going to leave them in the lurch.
And then this is a program she's talking about in a federal prison camp.
Right.
Is there a lot of job training going on in prisons?
There are vocational training programs in many different institutions across the state of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, they're underfunded as well. They do not have a huge budget to be able to provide for like welding equipment or even training programs or the necessary maintenance programs and things that are training in the prisons. But we do know of individuals who have gone through training programs in the institutions, gotten a job in the institution where they've been able to show their work, and through their experiences and through their trainings and what they've learned while they've been incarcerated, have been able to parlay that job into a very successful job on the outside, which is, you know, launched the individual into being permanent positive members of our community.
We're talking about the prison-to-work transition with Wendell Rischka from Project Return. Back to our callers. Luis is with us next in Lake Geneva. Luis, hi.
How you doing today? Thank you very much for accepting my call. I just wanted to state just a brief statement that I'm an individual who you can say was raised through the prison system from a youth from 13 years old, and I'm actually still on extended supervision. But I do want to say that it did take several times in my adulthood. I was caught in that cycle of recidivism, and it was mainly due to my thoughts and how I wanted it the easy way. And I actually believe it's up to the individual, because there is programs and there are ALDA programs. I did the boot camp program, but I still went again one last time. I've been out 8 years now, got a great probation officer, good relationship. And what I do want to say is that it's really up to the individual if they're ready to change or if they hit that point. And another factor that plays into it is the environment that they're released into, because it's easy to go back to what you know, and it's hard to implement what you've learned, you know. So it's worked for me. I'm working for a great company, a subsidiary of Harley-Davidson. We make metal, chroming, nickel, and copper. And my employer gave me an opportunity, and I'm now salary, which I never thought I would make. And I'm able to support my family in a great environment and area, which is Lake Geneva. Beautiful.
Luis, thanks for the call. Congratulations on the job. Wendell, he brings us back to something you mentioned earlier. It's not just vocational training, not just job skills, but really a mindset, a culture change in the mind of the ex-inmate. Can you talk about that a little?
That's exactly right. And I really applaud Luis for everything that he's doing and the way he's moving forward within things. He's exactly right. We can't help somebody that doesn't want to help themselves. If somebody is mired in their criminal thinking patterns, does not want to give up drugs or alcohol abuse, does not want to give up criminal thinking, wants to get the fast money and stuff, you know, they're going to find ways to do that. And unfortunately, any treatment alternative diversionary program is not going to be successful with that individual until they decide that they are not wanting to recede back through the prison system and they want to change their lives. What we're saying here is when an individual wants to change their lives, they should be afforded that opportunity and afforded the programming and the resources to be successful. And that's what we're working on at Project Return and with the 11 by 15 campaign and Micah and Wisdom and many different organizations throughout Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin is helping individuals through that process.
Luis, thanks for the call. Wendell, what would you say to an employer who's feeling maybe hesitant about doing what we're talking about and hiring a former inmate?
What I would say is come to the table with us. Let us sit down with you and maybe not necessarily give you somebody to hire right away, but listen to somebody's story. Understand where they're going through, who they are as an individual, and look at them not for the worst thing that they've ever done in their life, which is their felony conviction, but maybe for the potential that they bring to the table. So many of these guys are completely untapped potential and have never really been afforded an opportunity. And when given that opportunity, they just excel and blossom as an individual and as a worker, as an employee, and just as a person and a citizen in our society. We have individuals that we can put in front of you and stuff that have proven that, that are excellent employees. We have employers that can talk about that as well. There are benefits at the state level of work opportunity tax credits and federal bonding if an employer is worried about those types of things. But quite honestly, what you're looking at is you're looking at an untapped potential of resources here, individuals who have the ability to do the job, who are willing to learn, who are willing to show up every day on time and do the job and do it well. They're just looking for that opportunity.
Wendell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Wendell Rischke. He's executive director of Project Return, a Milwaukee nonprofit that helps ex-inmates adjust to life after prison, talking about the difficulties former inmates face in the search for a job. We've been on the air here on Central Time for over a year and a half now, and finally one of my original visions for the show has become a reality. Today we installed the long-awaited sound effects board so we can zing up the show with subtle but appropriate clips. Here's a quick taste of what we have available. Much as I enjoy the sound effects, I have to say, you probably expected it, April Fools.
Hi-yo!
Now, Joy Cardine's producers got into the April Fools spirit this morning at 6. If you missed it, here's Joy bringing up what she thinks is the bumper music in the midst of a conversation about April Fools Day.
That's coming up at the end of this hour. All right, that was perfect. That was an April Fool's joke. I was Rickrolled on the air.
Her producers did it. Joy was a good sport about the Rickrolling, and she was very polite when she fired her entire crew.
And I want to thank Kayla Blado and Cynthia Schuster and Christy Taylor and Bill Martins for producing this program. They will be missed.
If you are the perpetrator or a victim of an April Fool's prank today, you can tell us all about it over at the Central Time Facebook page.